pencil case, new uniform and a smile on her face. You gave birth to your baby, she's the fruit of your womb. Now you're gonna hand her over to the walls of the room. First they'll take it and they'll break it and they'll make her fall to hide. Steal the seeds that you sowed, do a number on her mind. Fill her up with propaganda so she'll wanna be a serf. For the dreams of Alice Bailey and the Luciferians. You should better watch out what you're teaching your children. Watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And as that brand new song from Dissident Prophet gradually fades into the background, and by the way, if you'd like to hear more of it, don't worry, I'll be playing the whole song at the end of the show. It's my great pleasure on this, the 25th of June 2014, to welcome to the programme Dr. Duke Pester, who is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and the academic director of Freedom Project Education. Dr. Pester holds an MA in Renaissance Literature from John Carroll University and a PhD in Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature from Purdue University. He has taught a wide variety of subjects at university level, both to undergraduates and graduates, and he's been active in educational reform, most particularly in recent times in raising awareness of the dangers of Common Core in the US education system, about which he has lectured hundreds of times across the US, and which he joins us today to discuss. Dr. Pester, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Thank you so much for having me, Julian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I first came across your work a few weeks ago when I saw a video presentation, or a video of a presentation that you gave on this subject of Common Core, and I was so impressed by the case that you made for the dangers of this education program, or I suppose I should call it supposed education program, that I was very keen to invite you onto the show, not least because you gave the warning at some point during that talk that although this program is currently being implemented in the US, the powers behind it are certainly looking for it to become a global phenomenon. Let me start, Dr. Pester, by asking you if you would to tell us a little bit more about yourself and how it is that you became alerted to the dangers of Common Core.
Well, as a university professor for the last 20 years, I've noted, like most of us have, the decreasing standards in American students, the decreasing ability of our American kids to write well, read well, to do critical thinking, to be able to engage in discourse at a high level. And so a few years ago, it dawned on me that I would have to get involved in education at younger grades if I was going to be able to make a difference by the time they reached college. And right about the time I got involved with a couple of different homeschooling programs, one of the alternatives, it seems to me, that is promising is to give kids homeschooling, let moms and dads sort of reclaim some of the educational parameters from the state. So in getting involved with a number of various homeschooling groups in the United States, my involvement corresponded almost directly to the beginning onset and implementation of Common Core, and it was abundantly clear that among the many problems with Common Core, one of them was going to be eventually an existential threat to the very nature of homeschooling. The big state paradigm that Common Core represents ultimately would not be able to allow moms and dads to continue to educate their kids outside that umbrella. So that's how I got involved initially.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us a kind of definition, a kind of brief definition of what Common Core is so that we can get a kind of handle on it for the rest of the discussion?
In its most basic sense, Common Core represents a gross overreach of federal power into education. The United States educational system is obviously different than some of the European models. The kind of control at the federal level has been blunted over the years. We actually have a 1965 federal statute in the United States that prohibits the federal government from creating a national curriculum or national education standards. And so Common Core now is an attempt to circumvent that. It's the federal government basically commissioning private entities and activists to construct the curriculum and the standards. Right now, we only have Common Core English and Common Core Math. Those are the two standards that we have. Every aspect of the curriculum will one day be standardized to Common Core if they get their way, including things like art and gym, even physical education and music will be appropriated by Common Core. And so ultimately what happened was is that two Washington, D.C. lobbyist groups, a small number of activists in these two lobbyist groups, crafted the standards behind closed doors. They were paid for by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates of Microsoft has put in about $3 billion of his own dollars so far to implement and create the standards. And then, of course, they were put in the schools. Bill Gates, for all his money, could not have inserted them into the American public school system. That took the federal government. And that was through a program President Obama instituted back in 2008 called Race to the Top, 2009, in which the federal government basically bribed 46 states in the union to take a set of curriculum standards that they really hadn't even seen yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hoping to get into more of that in a moment and the nature of Common Core itself. Could you tell us how far this has got so far in being implemented as a program?
Well, 46 states initially took it, four held out. In the roughly 11 or 12 months or so since we've actually been able to see the standards working their way through the schools, four other states have already pulled out. Another two or three will pull out by the end of the summer. And in about 40 states in the union as we sit here today, there are over 300 pieces of legislation at the state level trying to kill or dramatically curtail Common Core. But most of that legislation is pending. Right now, 42 states are currently on the hook for it and beginning to work the implementation into their schools.
And is it being resisted by teachers' unions at all?
You know, it is, interestingly. Very recently, as of January of this year, January 2014, the New York State Teachers' Union has decided to withdraw support for it. And that's big because New York is one of three states, New York, Kentucky, and Florida, in which the Common Core was rolled out 2 years earlier than in all the other states. So there's a two-year-long track record that the other states don't have. And there's also been two full years of Common Core testing in those states. And it has been an absolute disaster. In the state of New York, for instance, student achievement fell from the 78th, 79th percentile in reading, math, and writing all the way down to the mid-30s. And because of this and because of New York teachers beginning to figure out how little actual control they have over what is taught and how it's taught, the New York State Teachers Union pulled out in January of this year. And most shockingly, 1 month ago in May of this year, the Chicago Teachers Union, this is President Obama's own backyard, the Chicago Teachers Union pulled out and issued the most incredibly stinging rebuke to Common Core that I've seen yet.
And the National Education Association, I understand, says that Common Core is botched.
Yeah, the NEA called the implementation of Common Core. This is the largest teachers union in the country. And some of your European, some of your English listeners might not know, the NEA, the National Education Association, is right now the single most powerful union in the United States, period. It has more clout. It spends more money on lobbying than any other union in the country. And so the NEA came out and called the implementation of Common Core totally botched. And NEA President Dennis Van Roekel said the standards will not work without a rewrite that includes teacher input. So it's the NEA acknowledging that this whole system was put together without any meaningful teacher input whatsoever.
Okay, so perhaps the best way to get a really good idea of the nature of this beast, as I'm going to call it, is to look at the way in which it came to be formed in more detail in the first place, because I do often think that by, you know, you trace the development of something, it gives you a context to make sense of the ideas that are being presented. So could you explain in more detail how this came about? How did the US get to this point where a program like this seems to be in danger of swallowing up the whole education system?
Well, you know, if we look at the American federal government, certainly over the last 6 years and since President Obama took over and certainly over the last 20, we see an increasing tendency on the part of the American political class to want to nationalize things that historically have been left to the states, Obamacare being the most classic example. But the move to push, the same push now is on in education. And right about the time that President Obama was beginning his Obamacare legislation, his push for nationalized healthcare, he was also implementing planting the seeds of what would become Common Core. And so what happened was a very small group of activists, Common Core has been traced back, the writing of Common Core has been traced back to five individuals, chief of whom is a man by the name of David Coleman. David Coleman, it was a roommate in college of Arnie Duncan, who is currently the Secretary of Education for the United States. And so David Coleman is a has a long history of political activism, particularly with President Obama and the current administration. He's never been elected to anything. He's never been appointed to anything. He really doesn't have the kind of educational background that would qualify him to oversee the writing of national standards in either English or math. Nonetheless, he was put in charge of the five individuals who oversaw the writing of Common Core. These individuals wrote the Common Core state standards in English and math. They wrote them as part of two Washington lobbyist groups, the National Governors Association and the CCSSO, the Council of Chief State School Officers. These two organizations are basically Washington lobbyist organizations whose job it is to work with politicians to try to influence politicians to move certain ways on issues. This group was funded, as I mentioned before, to the tune of initially $150 million in 2009 by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And as we sit here 4 and 5 years later, Mr. Gates has spent over $3 billion lobbying for implementing and ultimately donating lots and lots of money to educational groups on the condition that they would support the Common Core standards. That's what happened on the writing of the standards front. Those are the people who put it together, and what ultimately they recognized was the only way this would get in the schools if the federal government moved. And so that's when President Obama created Race to the Top. And that was back in 2009, right when we had the monetary crisis, the economic crisis, when the president was stimulating things. He was spending billions of taxpayer dollars on car companies and banks bailing them out. At the same time, he created Race to the Top, which was a federal program designed to take billions and billions of dollars of American taxpayer money and hand it out to the states simply for their education budgets. So states had the ability in 08, 09, 10, and 11 to apply through various permutations of the grant, to apply to the federal government for Race to the Top grant money. Give you an example. Back in 2009, the state of New York received $700 million from the federal government, all sent to the Education Department in New York. They could spend that money on whatever they want, and there were no strings attached to getting this money from the federal government except one. And that string was, any state that took Race to the Top money in any form at all was obligated to adopt the Common Core state standards when they were finally written. Most of the states who simply took the money out of desperation for their state education budgets agreed to take Common Core even though they had not seen it.
So this is before actually the Common Core standards were written at all, is it?
Absolutely. And it is true, Julian, that after the standards were written and after the states had taken Race to the Top money, that some low-level individuals, education administration types at the state level, were able to look at the Common Core standard. But they could not change it and they could not reject it. So effectively, what President Obama did is bribe 46 states to take a set of curriculum standards they had not seen. Those standards were written by activists with deep ties to the president himself, all behind closed doors, all paid for by Bill and Melinda Gates. And all of this was done because the federal government simply couldn't do their own national standards. They are legally prohibited from doing so. So they did the next best thing. They enabled people close to them without any oversight or any way for American citizens electorally to get at them. That's the other thing. The copyright for Common Core is held by these two Washington lobbyist groups. So the educational standards that are now transforming American education almost overnight, the copyright is not held by the Department of Education or the Congress of the United States. It's not held by the states or the teachers or the moms and dads. The people who own the curriculum and the standards that are transforming American education are utterly unaccountable to the American taxpayer, to the American voter.
And this Common Core set of standards is very much philosophically related to the No Child Left Behind Act that you were talking about before. It follows the same kind of philosophy, is that right? The outcome-based education approach?
Absolutely. The Common Core replaces the No Child Left Behind legislation. No Child Left Behind was a product of the George W. Bush administration in 2002. President Bush looked around, as had so many American presidents before him, and recognized the struggling, the inadequacy of America's public schools in many respects. And so what he did is he wanted to transform education, and he farmed out. President Bush did not write the standards, nor did his aide. President Bush allowed Senator Ted Kennedy to and his people to write No Child Left Behind. So No Child Left Behind was really the first broad national standards that we had for American schools, broadly national, with tentacles reaching into almost every aspect of how schools were set up, run, how pedagogy was delivered.
And how did that fare?
It was a disaster. It was a disaster. No, I have never met a teacher, a principal, a superintendent of schools, a mom and dad in this country who has anything but contempt for No Child Left Behind. And the reasons they despised it was, one, it's outcome-based education. You're not dealing with the kids you have. You know, in America, we have a remarkably, remarkably heterogeneous group of students. It's not like places like Finland or Thailand or some of these other countries that are held up as models of education. Those countries have relative stability and relative homogeneity in their student populations. America, as we know, is just incredibly diverse, racially diverse, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, certainly monetarily diverse in terms of backgrounds. So the problem is with outcome-based education is that you are not dealing with kids where they are and specifically addressing their needs. You're trying to get them all to end up in the same place. And as we know, anything like a national standard for 60 million American kids, the only way you're going to get 60 million American kids to the same place is if you have the standards set relatively low, not relatively high. The higher the standard, the fewer the kids can make it. And that's what we saw over No Child Left Behind about a dozen years. For 12 years, we saw the standards that, however high they said they were going to be, of necessity had to keep declining to be able to get more kids to meet them. So this was a problem with standards-based education. Also, the high stakes testing, what we call the standardized testing. The only way to measure a standard that broadly is through these tests. And as many, many education professionals have pointed out, if you're simply educating kids to the point that they can take a test, you're not really educating them at all. You're just preparing them for the test. And it was really high stakes for the teachers. If you were a teacher who could not get your kid to the standard, well, then you might not be renewed. If you were a principal whose school couldn't get its kids to the standard, you might lose your position. And so consequently, we had a horrible situation in the 2005 and 6 and 7 where you had in this country principals, superintendents, even some teachers themselves who were taking the children's standardized tests, throwing them in the garbage, and forging new ones simply as a way of protecting their own jobs. And that happened in North Carolina, in Atlanta, Georgia, in New York City. So No Child Left Behind was a disaster for a lot of reasons. And to cut to the chase here with you, in my estimation, Common Core is simply No Child Left Behind on steroids. The worst aspects of No Child Left Behind, the one-size-fits-all education, the outcome-based education, the meaningless high-stakes testing, all of that is back in Common Core. The only difference being Common Core, because it is so top-down, it is going to eliminate the ability for states and local school boards and local school districts to have any meaningful impact on fixing it when it doesn't work.
Could we come back to the details of actually how this came into being? Because the next stage, I think, will be to talk about the validation committee. This is where content specialists in the areas of English language and mathematics were involved. But I understand that it was very, very minimal and that you would have expected there to be much more involvement of that sort of person.
Well, there are so many problems with the way Common Core was implemented. It was done in secrecy. There was very little state input. There was very little local input. There was very little teacher input. One thing that the Common Core people did do, after the standards had been paid for by the Gates Foundation, drafted, they convened a committee of 29 individuals. This committee was called the Validation Committee, and its job was to, well, validate the standards. And the people on the committee were given carte blanche. They were told, if the standards don't work, if the standards are inadequate, if the standards are unhelpful, get rid of them. You have complete carte blanche to do whatever you think is necessary. Well, interestingly, of the 29 people the Common Core brought to Washington, only one expert in English and one expert in math. Unbelievably, these were the two sets of standards being validated, English and math. Of the 29 people they brought to be on this committee, there was only one actual math specialist, a man by the name of Professor James Milgram, a Stanford University math professor. Milgram's a serious guy. He did most of the mathematical calculations for the Apollo moonshot in the late 60s, so he knows his business. The English professor was a woman by the name of Dr. Sandra Stotsky, also a university professor, now retired and living in Massachusetts, considered to be the foremost ELA expert in America today, English language arts specialist. Well, both Stotsky and Milgram voted absolutely no on the Common Core standards. In fact, so disturbed were they by the standards that they convinced other people on the committee to vote no. Milgram said, and I quote, "It's an absolute joke to think that Common Core math will prepare American children for college careers, for college math, or for STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math careers. An absolute joke," Milgram called it. Dr. Stotsky said, and I quote, "Common Core English will set our kids 2 years behind the 2 years they're already behind the rest of the world in reading, writing, and comprehension." They managed to convince other people on the committee, too. But what the validation committee did is, rather than allow Stotsky and Milgram, the two experts, to completely rewrite the standards, to throw them out and start over, which is what they wanted to do, the validation committee just erased their comments from the entire procedure. Stotsky, Milgram, and the others who voted no were, in effect, written out of the validation committee document. The remaining members went ahead and validated the document without any input whatsoever or even any mention at all of the objection of the two experts and the people they had convinced.
This is extraordinary. Can you explain what this validation committee is? I mean, is this something that is done at the state level?
Well, it's not necessary. The thing that's so frustrating about all of this is that this is none of this is actually a federal government business. The people who wrote Common Core, it's a private consortium who did it. So they brought in their own committee, right? They hired this committee because they wanted to get some expert approval for their standards. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to put a veneer of thoroughness on this. And you might even admire them for this, right? I mean, I think it's a good idea. They said, okay, we put the standards together. Now let's bring an outside committee in, including a few experts, to look at the standards we've put together and give us the thumbs up. And they were smart. They picked two good experts. Dr. Stotsky is preeminent in her field, as is Dr. Milgram. What they didn't count on is Stotsky and Milgram both saying absolutely not. When the only two experts on the committee said absolutely not, then the Common Core people had two options. Let them fix it and let them do it right, or to just simply write them out of the committee document and validate the standards that we have. And that's what they did.
It really is extraordinary. Could you tell us who Jason Zimba is? Because he's involved with this, isn't he?
Jason Zimba, David Coleman is the architect of the standards. He is the individual in charge of the five or so people most responsible for the writing of the standards. And Jason Zimba, Z-I-M-B-A, he is the man most responsible for the math standards. And that's a fascinating story about Jason Zimba. Milgram himself, who is very familiar with Jason Zimba, flat out says that Zimba does not have the mathematical ability to write standards at a national level. And in a very recent TV interview, a committee hearing he was at, Zimba publicly on record for the camera, I'll send you a link to the YouTube video, Zimba publicly admits it's true. Common Core math is not going to prepare American kids for college level math. He says at best, the brightest of the American students after Common Core might be ready to start math at a 2-year technical college.
So it's not gearing up children to go to 3 or 4 year university courses in a traditional sense.
Not in the least. No, it's not. That's not the ambition of Common Core whatsoever. As Professor Milgram says, Common Core requires, at the very youngest grades, it requires math way beyond kids' ability to do it. But with every year the kids get older, they're doing much and much and much less math. So it's completely backward. They're being assigned things they can't possibly do at age 5, 6, and 7. And then by the time they're 10, 11, 12, and 13, they're doing absolutely remedial math. I'll give you an example. In every high-achieving math country on Earth, every one of them, kids routinely start serious algebra in 7th grade or even 6th grade. In No Child Left Behind America, our American schools kids really didn't begin serious algebra till 8th grade. And under Common Core, serious algebra is pushed into high school. And that begs the question, as Milgram pointed out, if your kids aren't starting algebra until their freshman year of high school, how are they going to get calculus and advanced math in high school to be ready for college math? And they won't be able to.
Well, let's look at some of these standards in English and maths. Can we turn first of all to the English standards? And you say that the English and maths are in place so far. You say that science and did you say that history also is very soon to be coming online?
Yes.
Okay, so first of all, give us an idea of what the English standards are like. How they compare to the kind of course content that's generally been taught up to today?
Well, one thing we have to recognize, there's one piece of the puzzle missing here, that the standards themselves, the English standards themselves, like the math standards, they don't necessarily require specifically any pedagogy be adopted. And so people will say, let's just talk about the standards. Let's just look at the standards. Well, the problem with that is that the standards were written, among other things, with conjunction with the textbook companies. Textbook companies like Pearson Publishing. So what happened was, is the standards were written by this committee, then immediately the textbook companies started to provide curriculum and pedagogy to support the standards. So it really is impossible to look at the standards without looking at the curriculum that's grown up to support it. One of the ways people try to put you off track when you're talking about Common Core is they say, don't talk about the textbooks, let's just talk about the standards. And it's impossible because this was all designed to be a cohesive unit. The textbooks are written to address the specific concerns of the standards. Having said that, then, when you look at them in unison, we find that in the Common Core pedagogy that's grown up around the standards, up to 50% of the classic literature that kids historically have read in English class, literature that exposes them to the 2,000-year Judeo-Christian history of the West, the literature that exposes them to 250 years of American identity, the American experience, that is removed, up to 50% of that literature, and it's replaced with informational texts, a huge percentage of which come directly from the federal government. So kids as young as 6 and 7 and 8 now will be reading government pamphlets in their English class as opposed to reading the stories they've historically read. Among the things kids are going to be reading, the vast majority of the informational texts is absolute 100% man-made global warming and America's fault for it. In other words, they are reading one-sided literature, all dealing with a highly politicized issue at the federal level. They're reading President Obama's own executive orders. They're reading all sorts of government pamphlets that give a one-sided view. There's no critical thinking involved. Yeah. They're not reading books or pamphlets that challenge the prevailing orthodoxy. So at very young ages now, literature is being taken out and all the emphasis on character and moral development you get in the classic literature, that's gone now in favor of government propaganda being handed right directly to our kids.
So you say a lot of it is environmental material, extreme environmental material, but you also said in the lecture that I saw that there's a lot of sexual content as well ending up in this material.
Well, as Dr. Stotsky, the English specialist who refused to vote, she says not only her two big complaints about the Common Core English standards were, one, the replacing of genuine literary output with tendentious political pamphleteering. That's the first thing. And the second thing is of that literature that remains in Common Core, why is so much of it developmentally, graphically, violently, and sexually inappropriate at almost every single grade level? If you look at the literature that's left in, there's an alarmingly high content of very erotic sexuality in some of the books. The one that I point to in my lecture that has made a lot of national headlines here is Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. That's a great book. Toni Morrison's a great novelist, Nobel Prize winner, African-American novelist, but we wouldn't assign a book like The Bluest Eye to our freshmen in college. It's all about a 12-year-old girl who's the victim of rape and incest, and over the course of the novel, she comes to bond with her rapist and describes in graphically intimate detail the nature of their sexual encounters. This book has been found in American schools for as young as middle schoolers now as one of the recommended Common Core texts. There are other books like Dreaming in Cuban and Black Swan, and the list goes on and on and on, that are sexually inappropriate way beyond the level of where they're being asked to be read by kids. And at the lowest levels, too, even for kids as young as third grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade, while not being exposed to outright pornography, they're getting all sorts of suggestion, all sorts of risque statements. I'll give you one example. There's a Common Core lesson for fourth graders where kids had, they brought home a long paragraph, and the job was to read the paragraph and determine from the context of the sentences what the situation was. And the paragraph was about a young mom who comes home and sets about making the bed and finds a hair beret in the bed that is not hers. And over the course of 7 or 8 sentences, the kids are forced to conclude that dad is having an adulterous affair in mom's bed for kids as young as 3rd and 4th graders. And Stotsky's point is, why? Why so little literature altogether, and why is the literature that remains in Common Core so inappropriate?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be asking you exactly that question, why, when I come on to asking you about the role of the state and the growth of the state in all this. You also say that there's a much greater emphasis on writing rather than reading in Common Core. Why is that?
Yeah, at every level, every single grade level, Common Core lowers the overall level of reading by 50% and elevates the overall level of writing by 50%. So in every single class, including math, kids are writing as much or more than they're reading, or in the case of math, doing math. So they're writing about everything, but they're not really reading anything. And one of the reasons this is as Dr. Stotsky and many others have pointed out, is because if kids are writing more than they're reading, then inevitably they're going to be writing about whatever ideologically is being presented to them in the classroom. They are not writing about books anymore. They're not writing about character and morality and the large issues that are historically discussed in reading the great books. Now they're discussing the ideology and the politics that have subsumed for Common Core the actual subject matter that you're studying.
Which they're presumably going to be so bored by, because just reading informational texts hardly engages the imagination very much.
Well, you know, one of the ones I point out in my lecture is, one of my favorite ones is for high school freshmen. It's entitled Recommended Levels of Insulation, a report released in 2010 by the EPA and the Department of Energy. And it's basically a long regulatory manual about the environmentally correct way to insulate new building. Is that the kind of, do you think your 13-year-old daughter is going to, that's the kind of thing that's going to excite her to want to read more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you say that sort of thing is going to be 50% of what they'd be doing in English classes.
Yep.
Wow. Could we move on to the maths element to this then? Now, I wanted to bring up an example here that seems to be taking the internet by storm. And this is a short video clip of a curriculum director by the name of Amanda August. And she's talking about Common Core maths. And she seems to say that under Common Core, it's okay if children say, she has this example, 3 times 4 equals 11. And, you know, this is going mad on the internet. But I do think that that is unfair, given the context of the actual quote itself. Now, let me just give the quote here. She says, but even under the new Common Core, even if they say 3 times 4 was 11, if they were able to explain their reasoning and explain how they came up with their answer, really in words and oral explanations, and they showed it in the picture, but they just got the final number wrong, we're really more focusing on the how and the why. And then a parent says, we'll be correcting them then, right? And then she goes on, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We want our students to compute correctly, but the emphasis is really moving towards explanation, the how and the why, etc. Now, considering the context of the whole of that quote there, it seems clear to me that the intention with Common Core maths here is not to reward children for wrong answers, but to get them to understand what they're doing. Now, that seems to me like a good idea on the surface. But having looked at some of the examples out there about how this kind of thing is being done, I do have severe reservations about it, which I'm hoping we'll get into in just a moment. So now that I've contextualized that quotation, could you give us an idea of how Common Core maths is conceived and what kind of problems you do have with it?
Well, I do think your contextualization of Miss August's quote is a good one. It is true that she emphasizes that certainly we want kids ultimately to be able to do the right answer. The reason, though, that quote has become so viral is because it really is, despite her parsing of it, it really is the way Common Core math is being done. The emphasis is on process math. The emphasis is on communal math. I'll give you an example. One of the primary ways that elementary school math is being taught under Common Core is the so-called ParentShare program, where teachers, who are now, by the way, under Common Core, being relabeled facilitators because they want to take some of that responsibility away from them. There's already a big movement afoot in Common Core to stop calling teachers teachers and to start calling them simply facilitators. The facilitators in Common Core math, the job of the facilitator is, in these elementary schools, rather than teach kids mathematical concepts, rather than work problems on the blackboard, what you do is you put kids in groups of 2 and 3 and you hand them math problems. And the main purpose of that assignment is to get every kid in that group to agree on what they think the right answer is. Not necessarily to get the right answer. The serious bulk of the reward for the assignment comes in agreement, not necessarily correctness. We have a situation here in New York where I've got the actual exam where a little boy, a third grade boy, on a the math problem was 6 times 7. He writes 42 as the answer. He gets it marked wrong, and in red pencil, the teacher writes, "The other two children in your peer group agreed on a different answer." So they were given credit for the answer. But because the little boy who actually got the number right, he was not able to convince the other two kids he was right. He got it marked wrong. And there are a lot of examples. If you've been watching the internet, there are all sorts of examples of this kind of odd pedagogy that come hand in glove with Common Core.
And what age do you say this is taking place?
As early as third grade.
Wow, because I immediately associate that with adult education. And you know, you talked about the facilitator there and these sort of quasi-Marxist ideas of getting a consensus within a group, and that's the most important thing. This seems to have now penetrated right down to this very early age. It seems the same idea, really.
And I love the fact that you use the word quasi-Marxist, because that's exactly what this is. This is Professor Milgram calls it communal math with an emphasis on commune. The purpose is not to allow kids. Let's face it. We know, right, that not every kid is going to be outstanding at math. Most kids can get the basic concepts, and I was one of those kids, but I was never, no matter what you did, you were never going to turn me into a math prodigy, but so what? The purpose of Common Core math now is to make every American kid comfortable with a low level of math, because from a social justice perspective, Julian, it's just not fair that some kids can get ahead, some kids can do better. It's not fair that some kids could really radically accelerate the class. And so consequently, we should be more concerned with making every kid comfortable with the same level of math and not allowing kids to jump out too far ahead. In the same way, we won't allow kids to fall too far behind, although with a standard this low, that's unlikely. We're also not going to allow kids to jump too far ahead. And think about it. That explains why we're not getting to algebra till ninth grade. We're not even going to worry about trying to get our kids to algebra till high school, because we're much more concerned about keeping it low and basic so that every kid can feel comfortable.
Mm. Well, I'm thinking actually on with this pair and share thing that you brought up, I'm wondering whether it's really about maths at all at that point, or whether it really is the most important thing is to produce this consensus within the group so that people are not thinking about things independently at all. They're just thinking what the group is thinking. And of course, that's dictated to by the facilitator.
You have hit on what I would call my single, and Milgram and Stotsky and all the activists who are fighting this, our single biggest problem with Common Core. Up until Common Core, for the last 40, 50 years in American education, kids have been getting their ABCs and their 1-2-3s. But while they've been getting them, and this is true, I think, certainly true in Europe and the rest of the world as well, and at least in the industrialized countries, while kids have been getting their education in math and reading and science, they've also been getting a subtle subtext of very left-wing indoctrination. That's been true in America as well. Our kids have been learning their ABCs and 1-2-3s, but they've also been, in the course of being taught those seemingly neutral things, they've been pushed farther and farther left on the political spectrum. I think the big change in Common Core is that for the first time, certainly in American educational history, now we've reached the point where the ABCs and 1-2-3s, the actual nuts and bolts about how we teach our kids those subjects, that's now subordinated to the larger ideological narratives that right. The government is trying to impose on our children. We're not concerned anymore whether they do read and write and think and act and subtract very well. What we are concerned about is that more than ever before, that we use those subjects as a way to teach social justice or communal thinking. The way I like to phrase it is statism. Mm. If you would give me but one word to describe Common Core, the single word I would use is statism, to convince our American school children that they belong first and foremost to the government, not to their moms and dads, not to their local communities, not to the faith systems in which they were raised, but they are agents and they owe their allegiance and they owe whatever success they will have to the federal government. That seems to be the overriding purpose of all of Common Core across the standards.
And when you say that this is a leftist thing, I presume you don't mean in a party political sense. So that this would be identified with the Democratic Party, or the Republicans will be against it necessarily.
No, I think you're right. I think this transcends Republican or Democrat, certainly as they're understood in the United States. The divide between Democrats and Republicans altogether in the United States is vanishing rapidly. What you're beginning to see is a distinction between the political class, comprised of both Republicans and Democrats, and then the rest of us. The one thing the political class seems to have figured out over the last 10, 20 years or so is that Democrat or Republican, preserving the prerogatives and the status of the political class at the expense of the rest of us is business as usual. And one quick point about that is that's exactly why the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that's exactly why the House, the Senate, and the president all exempted themselves from Obamacare. Whereas everybody else in the country is laboring under the national health care law now, Senate, Congress themselves have opted out of it. So it's that double standard kind of governing principle.
Well, turning back to some of the examples of the maths worksheets and things that I saw online, the ones that I saw were very, very unhelpful. They seem to have an overemphasis on children showing they're working out on paper, not in the traditional sense where you show you're working. It doesn't really matter how you got there, as long as the teacher can see you got the answer that you did and it can be followed. But rather that the children have to follow a really tedious, prescriptive method of arriving at an answer, often involved drawing boxes and things and colouring things in, and it seems if that's more important than the business of computing itself. And that seems to go well beyond the kind of thing that Amanda August was saying. What's the idea with all that?
Yeah, and that's why I personally do like to use the Amanda August clip, because despite the tepid way she defends herself there, that's exactly right. In Common Core math, it is much more important that you do all of that extraneous stuff. Mm. You have to draw the right things. You have to have the right sketches going on. You have to have the lugubrious process. Even whether you get the right answer or not isn't even that important. What matters is, another example I can give you of a little boy that was sent to us. Little boy had a mathematical, an addition question, and the answer was 111. And so the little boy wrote 111. And again, he got it marked wrong because the math assignment called for him to draw, rather than write numbers, he had to draw 111 circles. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. That is absolutely incredible. So the only thing that's important in this is that you are doing as you're told and you don't have any individuality in this whatsoever.
Absolutely. And now you think about this too. Professor Milgram makes this point. One thing I can tell you, and I said this to you a little bit earlier in the program, what's really staggering about this, I could understand. I get it. You know, I've been a teacher for 20 years. I get that some kids learn differently than other kids. I understand that. And I believe that some kids might actually benefit by using visual aids to help them learn math. But the problem with Common Core math is that the standard way of doing math, adding in columns, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing the way we've done it for hundreds of years, in Common Core, kids are not only not exposed to it, they are not allowed to do it. If you try to add up a Common Core math question by doing it the way you and I learned how to do it, you'll get it marked wrong, even if you get the right number. The only way you will get credit in Common Core is if you absolutely avoid the previous ways of doing them and do them exclusively the Common Core way. And as Professor Milgram points out, there's no justifiable reason for doing this. If you did both, maybe you could make an argument for it. But as Milgram points out, the one thing that this leads to is a situation where American moms and dads can no longer help their kids, even at the lowest levels, with their math homework. Because there's no one way of doing it. That's the other thing that's so frustrating. If every time Common Core math was done, it was done the same way, a square equals 100 or a cube equals 1,000, even somebody as poor at math as myself, I could figure that out. But it's always something different. Sometimes it's dots and dashes and cubes and cones. Other times it's drawing, believe it or not, it's drawing animals. We have a situation where one elementary school, the kids are only allowed to add and subtract by drawing cows. And you have to be able to draw enough cows so that if you count the legs of the cows, you can get to the answer you want to get to. But if you don't draw the cows, you don't get credit for the answer, even if the answer is right.
God, is this like just in the first couple of years of elementary school, or does it go further than that?
It goes all the way through.
That's incredible. I mean, my own daughter has some experience of this. In the first couple of years here in the UK, she had to do this business of colouring in various boxes in order to give the answer to the teacher. And she found that incredibly tedious. After probably about, the first year of doing that, she absolutely hated doing it. But the idea that continues throughout the elementary school experience is extraordinary.
It does. And it goes on into the high school experience as well. I'll give you one more example about that. We're doing geometry. The American schools now under Common Core will be doing geometry, teaching geometry in a way that nobody has ever done it before. There's only one place in the world where our geometry curriculum has ever been used. The Russians tried it for about 6 months a couple of years ago. The Russian schools found it such a disaster that in the middle of a semester, semester, they yanked it out. That's the system now we've adopted for American schools.
What is that system again?
It's a system. It's a new way of doing geometry. We've done plain geometry for 2,000 years. Now they've created an utterly obtuse way of doing it that rivals at the lower levels what they're doing with all these boxes and squares and circles and shading, like you say. It's a completely counterintuitive way of doing geometry. The only place it's ever been tried in the whole world was Russia. They got rid of it the first semester they tried it. That now is the paradigm for American schools under Common Core.
Yeah, I also wanted to say actually about this new way of doing adding and subtraction. Actually, my daughter has something of that in her school as well, where you don't do it the traditional way that you were saying, you know, by you're carrying things from one column to another, but you add up all the units first, then you add up all the tens, then you add up all the hundreds, and then you do an operation at the end to put it all back together. And it's incredibly laborious. She doesn't even know how to do it the traditional way. And I do think to myself, as you said earlier, why can't she know both?
Right. And by the way, that system of tens is also part of what's being rotated into the Common Core. It's not just drawing the odd shapes, too. It's counting from right to left. It's the 10 decimal places. But it's not programmatic in a way that every kid's doing it the same way. So not only are they not getting, like you said, the way, teach them the way we learned how to do it, which is pretty straightforward. And then if you want to branch out and allow kids to try to grasp it another way, or those kids who can't get it the first way, but that's not what's happening here. Like you said, that goes away the way we learned how to, the rather intuitive way we learned how to do it, that goes away. Then we're bringing in all this other stuff, like your daughter's being exposed to at the younger grades, but then almost every single textbook, every single school uses a different set of markers or a different set of illustrations or a different set of exercises to get to the answer. And as Professor Milgram points out, the only thing you can ever say about this math curriculum is that it clearly forces kids to rely only on the schools, because there's no – I've got CPAs, certified public accountants. I've got medical doctors. I've got math professors in my state who cannot help their kids with their math homework. And as Milgram says, that is not a flaw. That's a feature for the Common Core people, that the only way the kids can get help is through the government schools. They can't get help from mom and dad or for grandpa. They can't hire private tutors to help them. The only ones who have the key to this very arcane math is the federal schools. And that's what's so shocking about it.
And it would seem to prohibit children from excelling in this situation. So what happens to things like gifted and talented programs? I mean, is a child allowed to show that they're finding it so easy they can push on with the work for the following year?
In the last 2 years in this country, we've lost more gifted and talented programs than in the previous 40 years combined. Because when you have this kind of rigid standards-based outcome system, it is as devastating to the system if kids accelerate the standards as it is if they fall behind them. I mean, and if you think about it, for a scheme like Common Core, you'd much rather have kids fall short of the standard, because you can always lower the standard, at which point you bring more kids to the standard. But if you've got a bunch of kids who are capable of accelerating and do accelerate the standards, well, doesn't that raise the standard? And if you raise the standard, then you're losing more kids at the bottom. We've got American schools. In my talk, I give a couple examples of this. We actually now have American schools, entire school districts in this country, who are threatening kids, threatening moms and dads not to have their kids work ahead in math. We have an American school district in Irvine, California. The entire Irvine school district in Orange County, California has on its website a threat. Apparently what happened is moms and dads in California were freaking out because their fourth graders could not add and subtract independently of all this drawing. So they started hiring tutors and they started having their kids work on more accelerated math. Well, the school found out about this and issued on their public website a warning and a threat to these moms and dads. And the threat basically was, your kids, no matter what you do, no matter what math your kids do and submit, your child will remain in the class appropriate math. It doesn't matter how far ahead he works. It doesn't matter how capable he is. Your child will stay with his peers doing what they do, threatening moms and dads. I can't think of anything more contradictory to the genuine spirit of education than American schools warning moms and dads now to keep their kids where they are.
But that's just one case. Has that happened in many other places too?
Oh, no. There are school districts all across the country with those warnings on their websites. You understand that when you put this kind of outcome-based system in, so rigidly controlled, with such obvious sociological and tendentious aims to it, that the fact is that kids who go ahead – screw that up. Kids who can do and excel and are capable of being moved up, if the entire paradigm is broken, you cannot allow that to happen.
So the end result of this is bound to be massive disaffection across the system.
Right. And that's what we're already seeing. We're not even 2 years into this yet. And you're seeing kids. We've got kids now in this country as young as second and third grade. We're talking 6 and 7 year olds who suffer from test anxiety. The clinical psychiatrist, the clinical psychologist, the child development specialists who are dealing with this kind of childhood trauma, not only are they being exposed to concepts that they're too young to be exposed to, but they're also, we talked about the graphic sex and the violence. These kids are being developmentally really, really poisoned at young ages. And think for a second, Julian, what this means. What does it mean to a kid in third grade who is capable of doing geometry or higher math already by the time he's 8 or 9 or 10, who for the next 4 years is going to have to sit in the same classroom drawing the same cubes and squares and triangles as everybody else, trying to master basic addition and subtraction?
I can't see how anybody could think this is going to actually help the cohesion of society. It seems to me that it would do exactly the opposite.
Ah, that's it. That is exactly it. It depends on how you define cohesion. Mm. We used to define cohesion as allowing kids to be educated, allowing kids through education to find out what their talents, their gifts, their specializations are, and to go and make a life and make a career. I think those days are gone. I think now cohesion, certainly out of the federal government that now currently runs America, cohesion means basic, simple socialism. Everybody at the same level all the time. Nobody having the ability to stand out too far from their peers. Everybody having a very low baseline set of competencies and knowledges, and nobody allowed to accelerate. And you think too about the benefit of this from the government's perspective. If everybody is only minimally functional in the ways that they need to be, then those people are much more likely to be dependent upon government and seek government to take control of things that otherwise free people would have handled for themselves.
So it won't be a case of people actually finding their natural place in the order of things. They will be receiving government diktat in various ways so that they can play the part of a compliant drone in a kind of big beehive. This is the vision that seems to be here.
Absolutely. And why else are we replacing children's literature with government pamphleteering? Mm. I'll give you one more example of this. In American high schools, up until very recently, we didn't begin career counseling kids until high school, the last 4 years of their public schooling. By the time a kid got to high school, we would 20, 30 years ago start trying to chart them a little bit, give them some exams, right, to try to measure their competencies and their likes and dislikes, to figure out where, if they didn't go to college, they might be comfortable going. Under Common Core, that career tracking testing now begins in kindergarten.
So this is the profiling of students, is it?
Absolutely.
This is something that a previous guest, Beverly Ekman, mm-hmm. brought up, and she was very, very concerned about this. But we weren't talking about Common Core. We were talking about this was actually happening before Common Core, but this seems to be gathering tremendous pace now.
Well, yes, it does. In fact, every single thing we've talked about today, Julian, precedes Common Core. It's just the difference between Common Core and what came before it is how absolutely top-down federal now it is. The things that were tentative, the things that were probational, the things that were being slowly implemented, now they've become absolute. It's all being driven downhill by this federal program. And so absolutely, yeah, it's profiling kids. And Bill Gates himself is a huge proponent of this. Bill Gates just came out 2 weeks ago and said it's not enough to start data mining and biologically metricking our children from kindergarten through high school. He now wants to do it for college kids. He thinks we should have data mining, data gathering, and we should be hooking our college kids up to classroom use MRIs and measuring their brain waves and their heartbeat, their pulse. The biometric aspects of this are pretty shocking. They don't just want to gather data on our kids in terms of their performance on exams, you know, basic raw data. They actually want to link the tests and the exams to a whole series of biological metering. They want to hook them up to blood pressure cuffs. They want to put them in posture analysis seats. They want to film them as they're looking at their computer screens. They want to be able to film and record their physiological, their emotional reactions to what it is they're reading. And they want to collect this starting for kids as young as 5 years old. They want to begin to create this data package on our kids at age 5, track them all the way through high school and possibly even college. And the federal government of the United States has already said they intend to make your kid's education file available to potential employers one day.
But all those things that you've just been talking about there, are they actually going to happen? I mean, is this just some sort of science fiction dream that somebody like Bill Gates is talking about here?
No, they're happening already. And you had mentioned earlier what the potential worries are for countries outside of the United States. Bill Gates has already gone to the United Nations and pledged billions of dollars to support UN efforts to try to put this into other schools at a global level as well. In fact, one of the key features, this is the thing that I think people don't realize. Common Core is a mechanism that's been built up to support the kind of elaborate data mining and record keeping that the federal government wants. In other words, there would have been no Common Core without this first being this grandiose plan to begin to biologically, physiologically, intellectually, and from a data perspective, begin to completely control and gather all these documents on our kids. It's a matter of control first. Common Core is just the vehicle they've built up around that driving idea.
And the driving idea, from what you're saying here, it goes way beyond school. This is encompassing the whole of society in future. So this seems to be a very technocratic vision about controlling the whole of society.
Right. And that's why somebody like Bill Gates is at the head of it. That's been a long time dream of his. I'll give you one more example. If you look at the 27,000-page healthcare law that was recently passed, and you can find dozens and dozens and hundreds, actually, of places in that 27,000-page document that empower the schools to become data gathering institutions in the name of healthcare. So now everything that goes on in our kids' schools is educational health, which means the healthcare law requires the schools to begin gathering certain data to comply with what the federal healthcare law demands.
You mentioned in the lecture PBIS, which is the Positive Behavior Intervention and Support System. And I looked at their website and it seems very innocuous. It seems to be focusing on helping teachers to cope with behavior issues in the classroom. But you suggested this is something to do with inputting information into the computer about the children on a daily basis by teachers.
Absolutely. It's innocuous in the sense that we want our kids to behave. And it's a staggering admission, isn't it, in the 21st century, that one of the biggest problems facing American schools is the inability of kids to sit still and learn. That's a whole separate issue. But the PBIS system is really kind of insidious. We have American teachers now who are spending as much or more time in their classrooms, logging, charting, tracking student behavioral issues, then they are actually teaching kids the subjects for which they were trained to teach them. And so what we've done is we've created a system now where the teachers literally have to become, and I would emphasize too, they're not necessarily helping kids improve their behavior. They are simply documenting, charting, and making part of the kid's permanent record whatever any, even the slightest deviation from classroom instruction. Here's where this gets insidious. Now, if you've got a kid who can't or won't do Common Core math because he knows how to do it the other way, or a kid who does not learn the way Common Core requires it, it's not intuitive to him, that now, under PBIS, that now becomes a behavioral and an attitudinal problem, not just a pedagogical problem. And remember what I said, these files that they're keeping on these kids every day, it's not just what their marks are, their grades are, what their performance is on tests and exams. Now it's their attitudes. Now it's their willingness to comply. Now it's how do they function in the communal group setting? Are they isolated? Are they loners? Do they see themselves as above the group? Are they unwilling to subordinate themselves to the group? These are the kind of things now. This is Orwellian.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I was thinking 1984, all the time that you were saying that. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. So you're teaching things which are actually going to put children off. You're going to make them wriggle around in the seats because they absolutely hate what's going on. And then you're going to log that as antisocial behavior.
Absolutely. And now, remember, not only is the federal government going to have all this information, but when it comes time for your kids to get jobs, if your kid is dyslexic in the fourth grade or has ADHD and is on Adderall or Ritalin, something like that, all this becomes available to the people who are going to hire your kids for jobs. And in a terribly competitive job market, it's staggering to think that they're going to be looking back to what happened in some obscure semester in seventh grade to determine who gets this job. But that's part of this Orwellian, you said the word technocratic vision that we have moving forward.
So would you say that that big facility that's in Bluffdale, Utah, is actually part of this whole system that's being set up?
Absolutely. That's not even a matter for speculation. All the information collected on our kids is going to be in part stored there in this huge multi-billion dollar facility the federal government just completed last year in the deserts of Utah. So shocking is this, Julian, that the people of Utah are trying to pass legislation to cut water off to the building as a way of trying to fight back against the federal government. And here's another thing. For all of our bluster, our governmental bluster, President Obama's bluster about environmentalism, this building they just built in the Utah desert, it requires 4 million gallons of water a day to cool the computers that store all this data.
So this isn't about national security at all, not in any way the traditional sense, only in the sense of guarding the elite from the rest of the population.
I think you're exactly right. You know, about 2 years ago, the president made a suggestion, and he's never repeated it, so I want to make that clear. Maybe it's a dead issue. But a couple of years ago, he dropped the suggestion in one of his press conferences that maybe we should consider in this country creating a group of 28 what he called elite universities. This would be the Ivy League, right? Harvard, Yale, the big high-profile schools in this country, UC Berkeley, right? Duke University. He said maybe we could take those schools, the 28 best schools in the country, and designate them elite institutions, which means that your kids, my kids wouldn't be able to go there. No kid could go to those schools unless he was picked by the government to go there. At which point, a student picked by the government to go to those schools would get absolutely free tuition, absolutely free room and board. Now, the kick is that what would be the criterion for the federal government choosing them? It's not about grades anymore. I guarantee you the Bush kids would go. Yeah. I guarantee you the Obama kids would go. Your kids, my kids, not so sure about that.
It would be right thinking, presumably.
That's right. Even the fact that he suggested that, and again, to give him credit, I've never heard it mentioned again. But even the fact that he was toying with the idea, I mean, that tells you, right? You brought up the idea that this is to protect the political class. See, in Europe, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, Julian, but in England, to some degree, you almost have a situation like that. In England, it's much harder to go to college, right? Having a pedigree, having a longstanding familial tradition, it's easier. There aren't nearly as many colleges and universities in England per capita as there are in the United States. Is it true in England that the dream of going to college is it's not like everybody gets to go still, right?
Well, particularly with places like Oxford and Cambridge, there are a lot of places that are for a certain class of people.
Right.
It's weighted that way very much.
But the elite universities, right, those are pretty much still boarding schools, grooming schools for the political elite. That, I think, is the idea that's making its way to the United States as well. That for the vast majority of us, we need a proletarian, utilitarian education. We should stop, give up the idea that we're going to have careers. And this is especially heartbreaking for America. Give up this idea that you can be anything you want to be. And we're going to educate everybody in this utilitarian fashion that qualifies them only for rudimentary entry-level drone work, yeah. Right? And meanwhile, the political elite will be able to choose. And you know what gets me? I say this all the time. Think about Bill Gates. Here's a guy who dropped out of college because it was not useful to him. Dropped out of Harvard University, opened up his own little shop in a garage and made $1 billion. If Bill Gates gets his way, there will never be another Bill Gates in America.
Yes, indeed. But you say that you suggested that this idea is perhaps migrating across from Europe or from the UK, did you?
Well, I don't know if it's migrating. I think that there's no doubt that I think that the American system has looked to Europe. The idea of a strong segregation between the ruling elite class and how they're educated and the rest of us. Yeah. That's certainly been a European idea. It's not. It's really not historically been much of an American one, certainly not over the last 100 years. The upwardly mobile ability of American kids, particularly after World War II, the kids of returning GIs themselves to go to college, there's never been anything like that in the history of the world. And I think that as we seek to move in a more socialist direction as a federal government, I think the idea, all socialist governments, they do need, don't they, a very doctrinaire, ideologically conformist group of educated people to run the show.
Well, I want to actually, not exactly to contradict you, because I don't think it does contradict you, but to give an example of a very elitist kind of attitude that actually was present in the beginning of the 20th century, because James Corbett brings up the example of Woodrow Wilson in a 1909 address that he gave to New York High School Teachers Association. And can I just read what he said? He said,
"Please do.
We want to do two things in modern society. We want one class of persons to have a liberal education. We want another class of persons, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, society to forego the privileges of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks. And then he goes on, we are either trying to make liberally educated persons out of them, or we're trying to make skillful servants of society along mechanical lines. So that was over 100 years ago. At least he was thinking in those along those kinds of lines.
Of course. Of course. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because certainly among conservatives in the United States, Woodrow Wilson is seen as one of the arch minds leading America down a more socialist road. There's no doubt about it. He's the guy at the turn of the century everybody points to. Of course, he was a college professor. He was terribly elitist. He was also, by the way, Woodrow Wilson, a terrible eugenicist. And, of course, the failed League of Nations. So it's interesting that you mention him. I agree. That strain, of course, has always been part and parcel of American culture. For the first 150 years, you weren't going to Harvard University unless you were one of the elite Massachusetts families. We understand right. that. I'm talking, though, more of the democratization that came between the period of the end of World War I and through World War II, when all of these possibilities, the corresponding with the emergence of America as a world superpower, right, with all of the wealth and all of that wealth and all of that newfound status. One of the interesting things that happened in America was pretty much a college, a university, opened on every street corner. And then over the last 30 years, 40 years, we've seen this, that and our politicians harp upon this all the time, that every American kid should have the right, the ability to have a college education. In fact, so much so it's gone the other way. College is now terribly oversold in America. We have kids in college who don't want to be there, aren't really equipped to be there, but the culture seems to be telling them that unless they go, they're failures. So oddly, we're finding now, we're beginning to have a shortage of craftsmen and welders, people who can do really high skilled, but not necessarily academic work. We're running out of those people while kids are languishing in American universities, racking up tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt and not being able to find jobs when they graduate.
Well, as we come very much onto this consideration of sort of corporate fascist statism, I don't know what else to call it, the other area that I wanted to ask you about was sexuality education. I'm wondering whether this view of statism we've just been talking about actually might illuminate what you said earlier on about sexuality education. Can you tell us why this is being done within Common Core in the way that it's being done?
Well, not only do we have this question that we left floating a little while ago, why is there so much oddly inappropriate sex in the Common Core? One of the answers is because right when the Common Core was being implemented, the federal government was also creating what they call the National Sexuality Education Standards. This is what they call, the subtitle of that document is Core Content, and it begins for kids as young as 5 years old. This is for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade, high school. And the national sexuality standards are pretty shocking. They're easily available online. And if you look through them, what it is, it's basically an entire paradigm designed to teach kids, expose kids to really graphic adult sexual concepts starting as young as 5 years old. And because they are a national standard, they're controlled at the federal level, and they will be tested. Again, whenever you have these national standards, the only meaningful way you have to measure them is these tests. And the interesting thing about the National Sexuality Standards, which were finally published, they were published in September of 2012, exactly when Common Core was being imposed on American schools, the process had begun. The interesting thing about the sexuality standards is that they are not meant as a standalone curriculum, which means they were not meant to be taught in health class or biology class. In fact, if you open to page 6 of the National Sexuality Standards, you will see that one of the things that they consulted with when they wrote the National Sexuality Standards was Common Core Standards for English and Math. Why in the world would the nation's sexuality education standards have consulted and been informed by Common Core English and Common Core Math? Well, the easy, obvious answer is that the National Sexuality Standards, in order to get kids that level of intimate knowledge about sexual issues, the only way you're going to get kids there is if you make it part of every single aspect of the curriculum. Why is there so much sex in Common Core English? Because you have to teach the sexuality standards in Common Core English, just like you're going to have to teach it in Common Core Math and Common Core History and Common Core Science. The National Sexuality Standards were created to be funneled in to every existing aspect of the curriculum.
So this is further evidence that the subject areas themselves are subordinate to these political exercises that are going on.
Absolutely. Why else? And even in math class, if you look at the way the Common Core math questions, simple story problem questions, why are so many of them graphic? Why are the situations that fourth graders are reading to learn how to do a simple story problem? Remember when we were kids, it used to be you got one train traveling, right, west at so many miles, another train traveling east. Well, now they're talking about really complicated issues like polyamory and transsexualism, using examples from that in the math story problem questions.
Yeah. So is this kind of the respect for different kinds of lifestyles? I mean, that's presumably how it would be couched.
Absolutely. This is a complete mainstreaming of any and all sort of sexual experience and doing it at exceedingly younger ages. Every time I've given a talk, I think I mentioned 100, almost 200 talks. I've spoken to maybe, what, in 200 talks, 90,000 Americans. I can tell you at every single talk and every single group of people I've spoken to, there's nobody in that room that starts teaching their five-year-olds about transsexualism, about homosexuality, even people who have no issues with those subjects. They all understand teaching a five-year-old about polyamorous marriage or teaching a six-year-old, right, about transsexualism. These kids aren't old enough to process this. But that's exactly what the national sexuality standards do, and that's exactly what we're seeing in Common Core classrooms. So what's happening is that the state is actually forcing kids to deal with sexual issues beyond their ability. This puts parents in a very difficult situation. What do you do? Do you teach your own version of sexuality to your five-year-old to balance out what's going on in the public schools? If you do that, then the public schools have won because you're teaching sex to five-year-olds. If you don't, then what? Do you just cede that the federal government's going to do that to your 5 and 6 and 7 year olds? So you see what a really untenable situation this is.
Yeah, in fact, a very similar conversation came up with Dr. Paul Cullen, who was on this program, and he was talking about the World Health Organization's standards for sexuality education in Europe. And very similar language is used in there. I mean, ages 4 to 6, we have this respect for differences in lifestyle and respect for different norms regarding sexuality. All this kind of thought is in there as well. Do you know if there's an influence there from the UN on this?
I would be stunned if it wasn't. I mean, the people who wrote the standards, they tell you where they got them. They don't mention the United Nations. They do mention the Centers for Disease Control and some other broader umbrella organizations. A lot of this is ironically being driven by the UN. I mean, there's a reason that Bill Gates has gone to the UN about this. I think what's happening here is you're beginning to see one more way of eroding various state sovereignty, various nation state sovereignty, is to begin to mandate in the name of social justice at the global level this radical tolerance regime, which is really not tolerance at all. You're programming kids. We've got a document in this country with over 250 clinical psychologists, child development specialists who've of every political stripe, Democrat, Republican, people who have signed a document saying, hey, this is not just developmentally inappropriate, it is borderline child abuse to burden children that young with the kinds of assignments, issues, themes and topics. Whatever your position on sexuality is, this is way above their ability to comprehend it. And we've got situations in this country, Julian, where we've got young kids. I mentioned we've got second and third graders now with serious test anxiety. We've got elementary school kids refusing to go to school because of Common Core. We've got young children, upper middle school kids, sixth and seventh graders, who are burning and cutting themselves because of the trauma of what they're being exposed to in their public school systems.
And you think this is directly the sexualization of the curriculum?
I've got over 200 developmental child specialists who make that claim professionally, that this is from their professional perspective, this is developmentally inappropriate to the point that you are inducing trauma in a variety of different ways with this.
Now, I do actually have a couple of extra questions. Yes, I wanted to ask you that in that lecture that I saw, you said that the biggest obstacle to these developments really is the Judeo-Christian, those people who hold the Judeo-Christian worldview. They have a foundation for concepts of right and wrong, and so therefore they're not open to this infinite managerial manipulation. So would you say that Christians and Jews and Muslims and anybody else who holds to these sort of transcendent values categories, that they are especially targets for this?
I think so. You know, in America, the American schools, we certainly have a long history of this. You know, if you think about unrepentant Pentagon bomber Bill Ayers, remember him from the 70s, who became an education professor, to say nothing of the Saul Alinskys of the world. Bill Ayers is an interesting case. He became, after his failed terrorist bombing, he didn't go to prison. He managed to escape prison. And the only career really open to him was as a professor of education, where he, for the last 30 years, he's been, in his own words, he's been bringing communism into the elementary schools. That's been his whole program as a university professor. Both Bill Ayers and Saul Alinsky, and people going all the way back to Horace Mann and John Dewey, the founders of American public education, both of them, particularly John Dewey, these are actually card-carrying Marxists. They have pointed out for about 100 years that the single biggest threat to communist, statist, socialist control is Judeo-Christian values. And one of the reasons why you saw it in the Soviet Union, you saw it in Mao's China, one of the reasons why socialist state programs are so heavily sex-based, how they market sex to particularly young kids, is because if you can get kids to become sexually libertine at young ages, it's very, very easy then to dislodge any subsequent moral remnants of Christianity remain with them. And so before you can completely bring kids around to statist indoctrination, you do need to divorce them from scruple, from notions of chastity and modesty. Those are things that have to be done away with. And that's a long-standing historical argument for that. I do believe tolerance is the Potemkin village. In the name of tolerance, we're going to teach your four-year-olds, your five-year-olds, all these radical different sexual postures, these ideologies, these worldviews, these sexual personae. We're going to teach these kids in the name of getting four-year-olds and five-year-olds and six-year-olds to tolerate everything. What you're really doing, I think, is you're absolutely leveling moral distinctions. And it's the tolerance movement. If tolerance is the only virtue we have left in a postmodern world, that means then everything else has been leveled, right? As long as you're a tolerant person, you accept everything, then you can do no wrong. And so ethical moral decision making, it goes even back to the English curriculum. Why are they removing the classic literature that helped our kids see things, help our kids learn to discern right from wrong, true from false, better from worse, and replacing it with the stuff they're replacing it with?
Well, this is a redefinition of tolerance, isn't it? I mean, I understand tolerance in the sort of classical sense to be that you tolerate somebody who has different views to you and you agree to differ. That's fair enough. But here, it seems to be that you're not allowed to be different from anybody else. And if there are any differences in culture or even in understanding, that's unacceptable.
And that's brilliantly said. I love the way you phrase that. But take it now one step further to Christian thought itself. Tolerance is one of the great Christian virtues. But interestingly, all the Christian virtues only exist if other ones exist. So tolerance as a virtue only exists if you can actually still have chastity. If you can still have chastity or modesty or humility, well, then tolerance has a place. And you said it exactly right. We don't have to tolerate improper behavior, but we do need to tolerate people whose ideas are different. But tolerance, the tolerance movement's gotten rid of all those other virtues, hasn't it? Chastity means that you're biased against people who are promiscuous, right? Humility means that you see yourself as better than people who are proud. So the modern tolerance movement has eliminated every single other virtue but tolerance. And as you phrased it, right, tolerance means that everybody's got to be the same all the time. That's tolerance.
So you get rid of any differences between opposites, as it were.
That's right.
Okay, well, actually, I can see a sort of spiritual leaning towards mysticism, but that will be another discussion. I suppose the last thing I wanted to ask you here is, you say that this needs to be acted quickly upon, because once it's set in stone, it's going to be impossible to move this. So what do you suggest that people do, particularly in the US at the moment, of course, to actually combat this?
Well, it is our historical misfortune as Americans in the 21st century. Looking back over the last 100 years, it's impossible to name a single federal entitlement, a single federal takeover of any meaningful thing that's ever been freed back to the people in the states. So my point is that this is digging its roots. There's a reason it's in the schools before anybody ever heard of it. They gave it a 2-year head start. They bought, paid for, implemented this, slipped it into the schools with nobody knowing about it. And the reason they did that is because they know once it's there, it's going to be hard to pull out. So killing Common Core is important. Even if we kill Common Core tomorrow, the disease is still there. Common Core is just the real ugly tumor you can see, but it has to be cut out, because if you kill Common Core, you're giving a setback to the federal control of this, right? If you kill Common Core, you're not getting rid of the sex, you're not getting rid of the bogus pedagogy, you're not getting rid of the ridiculous math problems. That's already still in our schools. The textbooks are going to still be in our schools. If you kill Common Core, all you are effectively doing is rebuffing federal control for however long you can hold them off. That's a big deal, because if you can kill that aspect of it, then assuming enough Americans have been motivated by this now to start actually paying attention to schooling again, then you could try to go back in and pull some of the rest of it out. So in my estimation, if you don't kill Common Core, then the Fed control of this will be so intrusive that you will never shake free of it.
And you won't be able to modify any of it.
No. And not from the ground up. Moms and the voice of moms and dads and even individual teachers will be utterly meaningless now. And we know, I know you know this is true, that the single most important way to educate a kid is between the parents, the kid, and the teacher. That's the triangle. But the problem with Common Core is it absolutely invalidates the parent-teacher-student triangle and makes that the least important component of education. Everything above it, and the higher you go, the more centralized you go, the more important that becomes. So in other words, that which works, letting a good teacher deal with a smart kid and a mom and dad who cares, that becomes utterly meaningless, and all that matters now is what emanates from brains in Washington, D.C. That's not going to be good for anybody.
So the state is becoming the kind of uber parent, and the teachers are becoming the managers of that situation.
Well, let's be generous. Let's use their word. The teachers are nothing more than facilitators for the state ideology. How about that?
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to leave us with? I mean, you said a tremendous amount of information here, so perhaps there isn't anything else that you want to add. But just in case you do, is there anything that you would like to leave as a final thought?
Well, I would say, you know, in some ways, American education thrived by the way it tried to differ from what was taking place on the continent. I think actually now we would be better served trying to look to some of the more sober aspects of European education as a way of trying to right our ship. In a weird way, Julian, I believe the American system has now surpassed the Europeans in terms of indoctrination and control. So you now, and Canada's another one. I think I've talked to a lot of Canadians that are absolutely terrified that this is going to creep north of the border. The statism has, at least on the education front now, has leapt way beyond what's going on in your country. So it's one of those places where I'm looking to Europe and certainly Canada to try to help us modulate some of our excesses. It'd be nice to see that happen.
And you've got a couple of websites, haven't you? Your main organization website, but also the Freedom Project Education is part of the main website.
It is. I work for I'm a university professor, but I'm also involved with some homeschooling initiatives to try and educational reform initiatives. Freedom Project Education. If you visit our website, it's free. No one's going to data mine you. It's Freedom Project Education, FPEUSA.org, and click on Common Core. You'll be able to watch Sandra Stotsky testify before the Wisconsin State Legislature. You can watch that free. You can watch Jim Milgram for 2 hours tell the Wisconsin Legislature just how bad Common Core math is going to be. So you'll get a lot of people besides me, a lot of testimony, a lot of serious articles and links to places where you can do all your own homework and you can track down pretty much everything we've said today. You can track it down and see for yourself. You really can't exaggerate how bad this is.
Mm-hmm. And how can people get in touch with you personally if they want to?
I'll give you my personal FPE email address. It's PESTAJ, PESTAJ at FPEUSA.org. Happy to hear from some of your European listeners. Love to talk to them.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, Dr. Pesta, I'm very grateful to you for joining us on the program. As I said just a minute ago, I think you've given us a great deal of detailed and helpful information and analysis, really, of Common Core. And you have made it abundantly clear, at least to me anyway, this is really something that does need to be resisted with great tenacity. And I think it does behoove us all to share this information with people so they can become aware of just how dangerous this program is. And God forbid that it should come this way as well. So thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed, Dr. Pesta.
It's been my pleasure, and if you ever want to talk again, don't hesitate to call.
Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Julian. Have a good day.
You send your child off to school with a brand new pencil case, new uniform, and a smile on her face. You gave birth to your baby, she's the fruit of your womb. Now you're gonna hand her over through the walls of the room. First they'll take it and they'll break it, and they'll make you fall the hive, steal the seeds that you sowed, do a number on her mind, fill her up with propaganda so she'll wanna be yourself. For the dreams of Alice Bailey and the Luciferians, you should better watch out what you're teaching your children. You
watch out what you're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what you're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what you're teaching your children. Just like the Jesuits said, give me a child for 7 years, I'll give you the man. Divide and conquer the prize from the hands of mom and dad. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Love the money, scales will fall from your eyes. Education, education, just a coat in disguise. After 10 years in the system, they can read and they can write, but they know the carbon footprint and they know the human right. Tell them that they're all evolving and a brave new world awaits. That they gotta tell their mama when they meet her at the gates. Yes, you better watch out what they're teaching your children. Education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Gonna take it, gonna break it, gonna make it for the highs. You better watch out what they're teaching your children.